podcast. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Sorry to interrupt your lunch, but we'd like to get going, as I'm sure there's plenty to talk about today with Humphrey. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Reuters, and it's a pleasure to introduce Humphrey today. Just a couple of housekeeping notes before we get started. Please do make sure you switch off those mobile phones. And also, just a brief note to introduce our next speaker, who's coming up on February the 22nd, and that is Mu Rong, an author from China, who's going to speak about the absurdities of China's censorship system. So that coming up later in the month. So, without further ado, it's a pleasure to have Humphrey Hawksley here today. Many of you have probably seen him on television or read his books, and he's been just about everywhere. He's here to tell us a little bit about his adventures, what life is like on the road as a foreign correspondent, and where journalism may be headed in the new era. So, Humphrey, I'd like to start by asking you what your latest greatest adventure actually was.
Well, I always reckon that the latest is the greatest, because in the BBC we say you're only as good as your next story. So it was actually last month I was in Uganda, and we went up to a place that's called Karamoja, and it's probably one of the poorest places in the world, and people have been living on the cusp of poverty for generations. Aid has been going there for the past 50 years, and there's an election coming up in Uganda this month, about a week's time actually, and I met the local MP there. And he did, and he sort of arrived in this battered Toyota pickup truck and got out. And we had to sit outside his constituency office because he didn't have the key to get in. And some battered posters of Museveni in a sort of cowboy hat, looking very spelt. And we got into a sort of Alice in Wonderland conversation that you get into a lot with people, because the president had just bought himself a $42 million presidential jet. And it happened to be exactly the same amount that Britain, because I was doing a British taxpayer's money, had given in aid to these people over the past 3 years. And this was emergency aid. So we would be told, oh, people are about to starve, and the money would come out. So I said to him, how can you justify your president having this jet when your constituents are starving and my taxes are paying for it? And he said, you've got to understand, my president deserves to be able to get around. I said to him, but David Cameron, my prime minister, doesn't have a jet. And he said, ah yes, but he's not threatened with terror attacks like our prime minister is. And then we went on into another. I said, well, could you, Uganda, actually afford to pay for all this starvation and everything there? He says, oh, yes. He said, we're a very rich country. We can pay for it. And I said, well, then why don't you? Why are we paying for it? Because we're coming up against cuts, and we're being told to tighten our belts, and hospitals are being closed and everything. And he said, well, I mean, the World Food Program's been here for so long, and they might as well stay. And I said, but don't you feel ashamed as a Ugandan not being able to feed your own people? Thought about it for a bit, and he said, let me turn that question around. Wouldn't you feel ashamed if you saw these people were starving and the British people weren't moving to help them? And at that stage, we just sort of folded away. and off he went to, I don't think he campaigns at all, because he said that the number of people in Canada, there's 1.2 million people there, and the amount of taxes they raise from that area is enough to pay the salary of one civil servant for a year, and one civil servant gets $20 a month. There was no opposition office or anything like that. And just to finish, as we were going back, it's a 12-hour journey in a car like this, and we were all bored stiff. The driver says, he says, see those, Humphrey? He says, they're the democracy poles there. And I looked around along the road, and every so often there were these sort of telegraph poles up there. I said, what do you mean democracy poles? He says, well, if you look at them carefully, and we were sort of looking at them, he said, they're not designed to put an electrical wire on there. So the MP comes along and he promises electricity to the constituents. He puts up a few old old polls. And then when the election comes, he just disappears for 5 years. And so they're called democracy polls. And I've heard this before. In Morocco, we had democracy water taps, where a woman took me around the village. They were having elections there again. And the MP had gone down to home base or something and bought a tap, put it into some concrete, and there was no mains water in sight anywhere. And then they had democracy roads in Egypt, which is another story. But that's my latest story. Whether it's going to be the greatest, whoever knows.
Well, that one may be hard to beat, but is there a greatest in terms of all the globe-trotting you've done? Is there one sort of standout story and standout experience that you've had?
Well, the one that underlines it is that, and I've been sort of doing it for the past 10 years, is I stumbled upon it in Africa, in the Ivory Coast, or Mali, actually, which is the country next to it, when we were doing a completely different story altogether, and it was about child labor or child slaves working on the cocoa plantations in the Ivory Coast. And the Ivory Coast supplies half of the world's cocoa and is bought by people like Cadbury's and Hershey and Mars and all the rest of it. And I was hearing whispers that there were a lot of child slaves working in the Ivory Coast in the most dreadful conditions. And I was in London at the time, so I rang up Mars, actually, the press office in Mars, and I thought, well, you know, this is a big multinational company and everything, we'll just have a word with them about this, and I'm sure they know how to deal with it. And the guy, and I said, okay, you just tell me what you're doing about these allegations. It's absolute lies, doesn't exist. I don't know where you got it from, and if you broadcast this story, we're going to do something, then put the phone down on me. So what does a good journalist do? He gets on a plane and goes there. And it was a sort of tragic thing, but there were, and there have been for years and years, these kids that they get, what happens is that they were in Mali or Burkina Faso or the neighboring place, and somebody comes up to them and says, do you want to join the Ivory Coast football club? Because Ivory Coast were written. And they say, yeah, absolutely. So we'll get into the car and we'll take you there. And they take them across the border where they get taken in by a sort of gangster trafficking ring. And they get taken to these cocoa plantations. Now, when you hear about a plantation, it's not like in Gone with the Wind and that sort of thing. These are sort of little acre plots where they grow cocoa. And they were put in sort of huts where they were shackled at night and they were allowed out during the day. And if they seemed to be quite frisky, in other words, escaping, they'd beat their feet so that they'd take their shoes and everything. All their papers were gone and they never got paid. So if they were taken about 11 years old, when they were just getting keen on football, they would only reappear when they were about 17 or 18, when they were strong enough and big enough to sort of get out of it. And this is what we discovered there. I went into this story once or twice, and when they got back to Mali, across the border, and they were rescued or they escaped, the Malian government kept a very good little record. It wasn't computerized, but a huge book, a bit like that guest book that I signed, right? But it was all done, and it had the name of the child and the date that they were taken, where they were taken, all the rest of it. So we filmed all this, got back, called up. I didn't call Mars because I knew they were a bit weird about this. I called Cadbury's or something like that. And they said, well, we'll get back to you, or we don't discuss it. A trade organization discussed it. And the next thing we know is that the head of news, and John Burt was the director general then, I think, got a letter, even before everything was broadcast, complaining about us even going to cover the story. And we put the story together, and it went out. And then I went back again. I've been back 3 or 4 times on this story. And at some stage, it wasn't the British government or the European government that put the pressure on, because I kept saying, what are you doing about this? And I kept saying to the chocolate companies, what are you doing? But they said, well, it doesn't exist. We've carried out, you said, you just stumbled upon it and it doesn't exist. But it was the Americans that actually forced through something called the Cocoa Protocol, which made them all sign up to it, all these chocolate companies sign up to it, with a deadline of stopping it. And then I went out there just as the deadline was about to happen. And they said, well, they're building pilot projects and they're going to create schools and they're going to do all this along the side of the argument that if Cadbury's and Bourneville can create these cradle-to-grave villages in Britain and the States, where they can, why can't they look after the people who produce their raw products? And attached to the whole sort of thing that you saw there is that, okay, if these companies are making millions and millions and millions of pounds, dollars out of this thing, why are the roads so dreadful, and why are there no schools, why are there no hospitals, and why is everybody living in the worst possible poverty, and what responsibility does a company have to that? And this sort of was percolating around. Then we went back, and we went back to the, in the Ivory Coast, to a place where, in Abidjan, they had told me to, I said, where can we go? It's our pilot project. It is all working here. You go to Ende, they said, which was near Yamoussoukro, which is the capital. So we went there. And I almost didn't go because I wanted to go and find out that it was still going on. I thought there'd be whitewashed walls and all the rest. So we went to this village. And I said, well, is this it? He said, yes, this is it. I said, well, where's the... There was nothing there. There was sort of a few huts, piles of cocoa, and these children with sort of pot bellies and all this. And I said, what have you actually built? Over there. And over there was a hut that was about the size of that window over there, which was meant to be a school. And I said, oh, okay, fine. When was it built? Oh, we put it up 1 month ago. I said, well, hold on, this protocol thing was signed 2 or 3 years ago. I can't remember exactly when it was. So why did you put it up 1 month ago? Oh, somebody told us the media was coming. So we put up the hut. And in the hut, there were the kids that they'd sort of got round, and they had been rescued from these plantations. And they had scars on them where they had these machetes where they themselves. And we did a sort of hands-up thing. How many of you like being at the school? And they all put their hands up. And then I said, how many of you want to go back to work on the plantations? Partly because one of the arguments of the chocolate companies is that they're all with their families doing the harvest, so it's all a happy family thing. On that question, several of them just broke down into tears. There was a real child trauma attached to it. And you can tell a child is a child. And these were kids. And I went back to London with this, and I talked to the Hershey's people. Well, they weren't Hershey's. They refused to talk to you. They put a sort of trade association on top, the one in Britain there. And you're in this Ugandan-style politician, Alice in Wonderland again. So I said, well, if you were serious about stopping this problem, why is this hut the only thing that's been built? And the woman, says, Susan Smith was her name, says to me, well, it's very difficult in Africa and we're trying to get it right. I said, no, but this was a particular project in that. We went round and round in circles on this. And I've got it all, the transcripts actually in the book. It goes on and on like this. And we get nowhere. And then I did the one from England, exactly the same. She then left that association to go and work with someone else because she felt so bad about it. And underwriting all this stuff is this idea of African poverty, really, a bit of stuff that is that if we are buying our chocolate bars from the Ivory Coast and they are making 50 or 95% of their foreign revenue comes from selling cocoa. And that revenue goes straight to the government. And the people that are buying it are doing nothing for the development of the company, and the government's just putting that money into their Swiss bank accounts. You're not going to get any development at all in places like that. In fact, what you're going to get is exactly what's happening in the Ivory Coast at the moment. You're going to get civil war because different factions are fighting over the cocoa dollars. So at the moment at the Ivory Coast, you had an election, so you had your democratic election. The president lost, but he's got so many cocoa dollars, he pays off the army to stop recognizing that and then besieges the winner in a hotel where he's been for the past couple of months, recognized by the UN and everything. And you have your democratic election and you have nothing whatsoever. And this standoff has been going on the Ivory Coast for 2 or 3 months. There'll probably be a war out of it. And I was talking to a broker, commodity broker. He says, it's all right, Humphrey, don't worry. We're still getting the cocoa out of San Pedro. And that's all that matters to them. very close to my heart, that thing, and I think I'll probably go back there when it's... We had a crew down there, actually. It's one of those sort of stories that a good friend of mine, Andrew Harding, who's the Africa correspondent, Pete Emerson, they were in Abidjan, and they were with a fixer and that sort of thing. They were driving just out of their hotel, round a corner, it's just out of a movie, into a checkpoint. And at the checkpoint, everybody out of the car, guns cocked, down on the ground, rifles at heads, and the local fixer that was with them dragged off to be executed. And it was only Andrew's sort of common sense that all this was happening, he managed to spot in the crowd at that checkpoint the army commander. The rest of them were politicians and militias. And he managed to get through to him to sort of stop all that happening, and they came back and didn't go any further and left quite quickly, because it was a sort of country where it's just too dangerous to do anything in.
Obviously, the experiences you've had shaped a lot about what you write about democracy, what you debate about democracy, as you did last night with Intelligence Squared. Meanwhile, we've got a massive story brewing about democracy in Egypt. How have you been looking at that? And would you want to go back there as a foreign correspondent, despite the stories that you're hearing about people being beaten up or detained?
Well, if you're with the BBC now, that ever since the Balkan Wars in the early 90s, we started getting serious about security. So out in Egypt, they have a lot of what we call security advisors with our teams, so that you're pretty safe if you're a BBC person probably going out in that sort of thing, because you've got a guy watching you all the time who's a former SAS guy or something like that, so he knows about all these things. But now, I mean, journalism is changing so much, but you've got all these bloggers and freelancers and that are all going out into the square, and I'd say that it could at some stage get quite dangerous. I mean, we had one of our people was taken in for 3 hours, bag over the head, handcuffed and all that sort of stuff. This was a week or so ago, and then released. And I think Egypt's getting quite nasty. It's the Middle East. Neither side is backing down. There was a chance about a week ago when compromises were made that it could have all unfolded. But Mubarak didn't go, and the demonstrators didn't go, and now something's going to have to give. So I'm not happy about, you know, what's happening there. It's going to be... I might, after leaving, getting back to London, I might have to go out there. And well, I need to go out there anyway. But another interesting thing about this way journalism has changed is that for the whole of last week, we were putting that story together in London. We had a whole team out there, but the anchor of the story was being done in the basement of Television Centre, because when you have the rolling news going on of that sort of thing there, you've got Jeremy Bowen or somebody going out getting stuff, but we've got to hit an update every hour. So I was sitting in a edit suite for 12 hours a day in Television Centre, or going on set if something's developing, so that whatever's happening, you've got the story and you've got a sort of ballast of the story going on there.
But presumably when you started out in this business, if there was a major story brewing, you could go out in the field, really do some research and learn about what was going on before you reported it. As you just mentioned, the way the Egypt story is unfolding, it's live, we're seeing it all the time, everybody's chirping in. Can you actually really do good journalism in the new format of television news?
Yeah, you can. I mean, I remember when I was based here, back in the early 90s for the BBC, the place to go to be, and there was the Vietnamese boat people question was happening there, and the sort of wonderful place to go to was Hanoi, because they only had two Thai Airways flights in a week, and they were always overcrowded, and the planes were always breaking down. And if a British minister or something was there, he would get on the plane and go back, and you had to stay and file. And so I did this a couple of times, and then suddenly that plane would go, and you would be left for 4 days in Hanoi with no telephones, nobody getting hold of you, nothing like that, where you could actually go and do what you say, because nobody would, and you'd have a wonderful time. But that's completely changed now. So can you do it? I think you have two levels of what's going on. If you're doing the rolling news, like I was saying last week, you really are doing it on the hoof. And you've got to be very careful about what's happening and making sure that you've got the balance right, even when you're updating every half an hour. And you can have something happen at 10 minutes to the hour and you've got to repackage it for the top of the hour and still get it right. And then, but if you go back from that, you can still go and do, say, the trip that I did to Uganda, which was about, it wasn't technically about that MP, it was about a change in the way aid is being done to try to stop poverty and all that sort of stuff. And they do give you time to do that sort of thing still, touch wood.
So you don't think good journalism is dead despite people uploading stuff on YouTube, Twittering away, et cetera?
WikiLeaks,
yep.
No, WikiLeaks is a funny one. The Julian Assange, who's the WikiLeaks guy, who's the one lesson from him that goes around is don't go and have sex in Sweden anymore because it's too dangerous. And I was actually in the States when WikiLeaks broke, and we put in a night shift at the BBC to do that. And then everybody wanted to find out where Julian Assange was. And I got back, and they said, Humphrey, do you know where Julian Assange is? I said, no, I've just come back. I don't know where he is, you know. And it turns out, everybody knows now, he was staying at the Frontline Club in London, which is sort of the equivalent of the FCC, although much newer, with a great character who founded it, a cameraman called Vaughan Smith. And in the BBC, there was this sort of corridor whispers going on, because we all know Vaughan quite well. We know the Frontline Club very well. And somebody, we reckon, you know, must have known. So somebody comes up to me and says, Humphrey, you sure you don't know where Julian Assange is? And I say no. And then you see a similar conversation go on down the corridor with somebody else and somebody else. And then suddenly, there he is, at the equivalent of the FCC, which actually, if you think about it, is the most obvious place for him to have been. And the guy that's doing it is an old, he sort of cut his teeth in Bosnia. Live, a great sense of theatre. Does Vaughan like. So when Julian was taken for his first hearing, Vaughan turns up in his Bosnian armoured Land Rover and puts in there that tiny little screen, bulletproof screen at the front, and the two of them sitting in this thing. And Vaughan is a fantastic character because he comes from the Norfolk landed gentry. So not only is he founded this club by mortgaging his huge pad down there, he then offers Julian, whilst he's waiting on bail and everything, the bail place that he is his mansion in Norfolk. So the tabloids have a field day with this, of course. They have, you know, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, the most wanted man in America, on this pheasant hunting, shooting and fishing mansion with Persian carpets hanging on the wall and all the rest of it. But where were we? We got sidetracked there a little bit.
just a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't think you think journalism is dead.
No.
Judging by what you're saying, I guess is... The new media, is it changing the way we do journalism? Is it degrading it a bit?
No, I don't think. I mean, if we go back to WikiLeaks before we got
was the Persian carpet?
Yeah, the Persian carpets. God, essentially, no, I don't think it is. But WikiLeaks has sort of set new benchmarks. But what's happened there is the too much information element and the technology. So WikiLeaks is not necessarily about Julian. There would have been a Julian would have come up anyway. WikiLeaks is about technology, in a way, overtaking events. So you have that, you have your Twitters, and you have your this and your that, and you get the Twitter news from Cairo and all the rest of it. But it still needs somebody to interpret it. And in the case of WikiLeaks, that went to four major newspapers that went through all that stuff and decided what should run and what shouldn't run. And we just had, just before I left, I was unable to go to it because I was doing a story, but somebody was coming around the BBC teaching us how to Twitter. So she was setting up our Twitter accounts. And one of our producers, Eleanor Montague, had gone over that the day after that to the Charles Taylor's War Crimes Tribunal. And I was reading the website on that tribunal, and it said, Charles Taylor's War Crimes Tribunal has been adjourned because the lawyers walked out, according to BBC producer on Twitter. And that's you know, this is the way it's going. We've got to do, you know, the reporting of top news is going to be 140 characters. But still, somebody has got to interpret that and make sure that what we get, well, we can go either way as readers. You can go and read all the Twitters and all this sort of stuff. Or you can actually wait for it to come out in the New York Times or the Guardian or the BBC website or Reuters or something where you know that you've got a digested view of it.
Pick up from Twitter.
Yeah.
Let's open it up to the floor. There's microphones. If you raise your hand, tell us where you're from. Questions for Humphrey. Right over here.
How do you do? I'm Bonnie Engel. I report on Asian art, so you're not exactly my demographic. But you advertised Osama bin Laden and Steve Jobs. Can you give us a two-minute little catch-up on that?
Yeah, can I have three? The great story of bin Laden is when the American troops went into Afghanistan in, what was it, 2001, right? 10 years ago. They were using old Russian maps to find out where they were. And then, so they were getting lost and all that sort of stuff. And in the sort of decade on from there, things have changed dramatically. And so during the reporting that I've done on the war on terror, one of the people I went to interview was the Americans have something called DARPA, which there's their defense and research agency that came out when Sputnik first went up into space. And the Americans said, well, hold on a second, how come the Russians are ahead of us? So I went to see the DARPA people, who were great. And they told me the story. I said, what are you doing now? I said, well, you know, when Afghanistan happened, they had Russian maps. So they had been working for a long time on sat-nav, which we all have now. I don't know if you need it in Hong Kong, but everybody's got a sat-nav now. And they, what they did is they speeded that up and then paid for it by commercializing it. So they run the satellites that do the sat-nav, and that's how they managed to pay for it and then put it in all the tanks so they didn't have to have Russian maps at all. And I said, well, what else have you done? And he said, well, we were sending emails to each other back in 1971 or something. They invented the whole email thing. Now, it was the World Wide Web that commercialized and brought it out, but it was their technology that underwrote it. So I said, okay, well, what are you working on now? Thinking he was going to come up with something really thing. But of course, they were fighting the Iraq and Afghan war now. And he said, we're doing checkpoints. So what about checkpoints? He said, well, what's happening at checkpoints, where there are so many mistakes, is because the soldiers don't know what anybody's saying and the interpreters aren't always reliable. So now they're setting them up with a piece of equipment, something there, that does simultaneous translation in, and they're doing Farsi and Arabic and Persian and all those things that they think they might need, so that you're not gonna, so that the soldier at the checkpoint is gonna be completely aware of what's going on. And I said, oh, that sounds useful. And he said, yeah, wait, because you'll be able to get it for your kids or whatever soon, because we're going to need someone to pay for it. And so when we get up to the Steve Jobs, it's basically that theme. So in the past 10 years, I mean, we're still doing this war on terror. This whole Islamic thing in Cairo is still with us. But the technology of the world we live in has sort of gone enormously along here. And I think the reason I came up with this is because I had a deadline, you know, the Hong Kong time difference and everything. So they said, we need this by today, and today was about to finish in Hong Kong, so I sort of rushed it off. But essentially, I've just been given this this thing here, which is the iPhone. And soon, it's going to be, the BBC's dumping the BlackBerry and giving the iPhone, and very soon, we're going to be able to do everything on it. So it's got an auto cue on it. You're going to be able to record your pieces on it. You can do a piece to camera with the camera and then satellite it through to something. You'll be able to soon, without doubt, sort of cut pieces on it and simple filming on it because the quality is very high. So bin Laden to my iPhone is what's happened in the past 10 years.
We get the connection. I think we had a question over here. Yeah.
Yeah, Nick Bibby, worked for an investment management firm. Just wondering if you could expand further on Egypt and how willing the actual military establishment will be to giving up power.
It's complicated and universal. So not being there at the moment talking to them, I can give you a rough, is that if a phone call came through from the US telling the military to get rid of Mubarak, they would, I suspect, do it, because they live off $1.5 billion worth of US money. But the dilemma that everybody has on this is that if you strip away that stuff there and the demonstrators get more power, which they are getting day by day, is that the military itself will not be a unified force. And so if, and don't forget, within the military, then underneath that you've got the police and the secret police and the intelligence service and all the rest of it. So in order, in my view, and last night when we had an Intelligence Squared debate, my view was not agreed with on the other side, but in my view, if you strip away the military and then suddenly say, right, well, the military no longer has the power it has, we're going to have a civilian government and elections and all the rest of it, it can get very rocky indeed. I covered the Philippines in 1986 after Marcos went. And in that case, the military was not stripped of anything and it didn't lose any power, but it didn't understand how the world worked. And I covered, I think, 7 or 8 coups against Cory Aquino then, because they wouldn't settle. And that's the Philippines. The Middle East is much more volatile. And this is the dilemma that they've got in Washington right now. Partly it's America's fault. It's not all America's fault, because in 2005, Condoleezza Rice in Cairo came up with this very famous thing saying, for 60 years we have supported authoritarian governments and favored stability over democracy, and now we're going to let the people of this part of the world have their democratic freedoms, and we won't do that anymore. But they didn't do anything, actually. They said the speech, and they didn't do anything, and now they're actually having to face those consequences. But in my view, a good scenario would be that Mubarak goes, Omar Suleiman becomes a transitional figure, and reforms come in. But the problem you have with that, and we've seen it all over Eastern Europe, is that when you have these reforms coming in, if you run the customs agency or you run the police or you run whatever, you've got all sorts of dodgy deals that keep you rich because you're not living off your salary. And those dodgy deals that are keeping your children educated or your swimming pool watered or whatever, or your mother in hospital treatment or whatever it is, are all at risk. So people begin to cling on and they dig in. So you can begin those reforms and you can allow 10 years for them to happen. But on the time scale of our media and Western democracies and all the rest, and what the protesters want, that's unlikely to happen. So my actual prognosis for it is, last week when the compromises started, I thought it might settle it down like Tunisia did, but now I think it's gone too far. I think it's going to be quite bloody.
Time for one or two more questions. Over here.
Humphrey, my name's Jamie Spence. I'm not involved in the media or anything. I work for myself. I just got a question with respect to how does the world go about remunerating and looking after journalists going forward, print media and any journalists, when nobody wants to pay for anything anymore and it's available online and you can get every, so whether it's a magazine or a newspaper or whatever, journalists have been passionate and as you said, insightful and able to interpret events. But access to all that stuff is very easily or readily available now through technology. How is a person who's raising a family and made 20, 30 years out of journalism going to be able to sustain that going forward?
I think the short answer to what you said is go into a different profession. Because
we're out of here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, America's really suffered from this, and they've been, I mean, the Washington Post has closed bureau after bureau, the Los Angeles Times barely exists anymore. And there are some very, very highly esteemed journalists that started their own blog magazine, and they were writing for it for free in order to hope that it would get up, but nobody's reading it. So I think the answer to your question is that it's going to get tougher and tougher and tougher. The broadcast media is expanding, but you're going to have to be very multi-skilled at it. So you're going to have to be a technician and a journalist and a this and a that. So the skills of actually making editorial judgment are going to be diluted. The skills of the cameraman are being diluted, and all those things are being diluted. But at the same time, the expectations of the audience and the readers are being diluted, because now people read 50, 140 character Twitters a day and think they're informed about the way the world works. They look at a video on YouTube and they think that that is how it is. But this is a moving feast, because Rupert Murdoch's trying to break through the barriers with his paywall on the Times and on that. He started the iPad thing now. So I know he's a controversial figure, but as far as I'm aware, he's one of the only people that's actually trying to break boundaries in that direction and still trying to make money from it. And give him his due, he did do that with Sky and nearly went broke doing it. We at the BBC have got, we're closing our internet down. I think we're closing it by 30%. We're cutting the world service back, which is hugely controversial. I think it's completely unnecessary. But we're getting a lot of jobs going from there. So I think you're going to just see a dilution of this stuff going on. But it doesn't mean to say there won't be good journalism. But it's going through that. And again, it's like the WikiLeaks stuff. It's technology driven. This whole thing is technology driven. There's no bad man out there saying this is what's happening. It's just everybody trying to keep pace with the new technology.
Let's try not to end this lunch on a depressing note for the industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really interesting stuff. Is there any other questions from the audience? Right over here. We'll have to make this the last one, I'm afraid.
Hi, I'm Susan Madden. I'm a nonprofit management consultant. I have a frivolous question, and for you journalists and correspondents, I apologize. I'm not, so I'm going to ask it. How do you guys keep fit and well on the trail? I've always wondered. I see you reporting from here, there, everywhere, and I have no idea how you do it. Please.
That is about one of the best questions I've ever been asked, actually. Because I ask myself all the time. It's a nightmare. you don't. You make sure you do that when you're back home. I mean, in this trip I did up to, I'd get on Uganda, I mean, it was... you're in a car like this, going like this, and then you're out in the sun, and you're moving about, you're doing a lot of things, but you're not actually doing that exercises, the cardiovascular and the press-ups and all that sort of thing, and you think, oh, well, maybe I should just do that. And then as you're thinking about it, you fall asleep. But I think you just get exhausted in the pressure of the day. But this idea of taking your personal trainer and your stylist with you and all that sort of stuff, no. And that's probably one of my ambitions, is to have my portable gym coming behind me.
So you do need a producer.
Yeah, you need a producer. Yeah.
Anne-Marie, I know you had a burning question as well to wrap it up.
Yeah, why do all senior male BBC journalists wear light blue shirts and beige trousers?
It's because of the Marks and Spencers opposite TV Centre. Can we get it? This is the dark blue one. And I had a light blue one in the wardrobe, but I thought you might ask that question. But your shirt colour is very important, actually. It depends on the colour of your hair. I'm good with blue, and I've tried them all. I've tried maroon. Light is no good with me. And we have colleagues that don't accept... I mean, the worst thing is to be like this and wear white. Then you get burnt out. And you talk about good journalism. Most of the time when you're doing your piece to camera, you're working out if your hair's right, or you've got the makeup on right, or you've got the right color shirt, or if it's creased. You've got to always have, wherever you are, you've got a, this thing, if you go to the back here, it's called non-crease easy care. It's not a sort of Jermyn Street cotton shirt. It's a 15 quid Marks and Spencer's no iron easy care shirt. And that's the ones you live by.
And now we know. Humphrey Hawksley, thank you very much for sharing this time. A small small gift from the FCC.
Oh.
To take home or to take to Egypt with you.
Oh,
to keep you safe
much.
On the road.
Is this an easy care shirt?
I'm not sure, actually, but it may need some ironing. Thanks very much, everybody. Have a lovely afternoon.